Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future environment. It is part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information online at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2. You'll also find us online at will.illinois.edu. With President-elect Obama set to assume power next week, President George W. Bush will address the nation one last time as chief executive. Join Melissa Block and NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving tonight at 7 for live coverage of the speech. They'll also provide analysis of the outgoing president's concluding remarks. That's tonight at 7 from NPR and AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today to the Afternoon Magazine. This afternoon, in this hour of the program, with the help of two political scientists, we'll look at the political gifts and abilities of President-elect Barack Obama. We'll ask if and how he is a transformative figure in national politics. And what does Barack Obama's political career to date tell us about the president he will become following his inauguration? Those are the questions we'll take up in this hour of the program. Our guests are Martin Dupuy and Keith Bockelman. They are the authors of Barack Obama, The New Face of American Politics. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Martin Dupuy is Assistant Dean of the Burnett Honors College and Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Central Florida. He earned a Ph.D. from the University of Southern California and a J.D. from American University. Keith Bockelman is Associate Professor of Political Science and Research, and he is with the Illinois Institute for Rural Affairs, Western Illinois University. He earned his Ph.D. from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Their book, Barack Obama, The New Face of American Politics, is published by Prager. And the phone numbers, if you'd like to join the conversation this afternoon, join our discussion, 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Martin Dupuy, Keith Bockelman, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for inviting us.
Yeah. Good afternoon, Celeste. So, Keith, greetings from Champaign-Urbana.
Thanks.
Okay. Well, when the two of you wrote this book, Barack Obama was a contender for president. How bright did you think his prospects were for winning the nomination and the election?
At the time, they didn't look very bright, Celeste.
Yeah.
We wrote the book first analyzing the U.S. Senate race, and that in its own right was a historic, remarkable campaign. And there's a lot of similarities, actually, between the U.S. Senate race and the presidential race. In both cases, I think Mr. Obama came from behind and was the underdog.
Yeah. Now, you note in the book that Illinois has elected several African Americans to statewide office, and it sent more African Americans to the U.S. Senate than any other state. Two, now three, although Mr. Burris hasn't been elected to the U.S. Senate. Why Illinois?
Well, I think it's partly a demographic issue. I think you are able, I mean, Carol Moseley Braun, I think, showed Barack Obama the way initially of building this coalition of African Americans, particularly in Chicago, but not solely, and then also white liberals, and a multi-candidate race, that that being enough to win a Democratic primary. So I think the demographics of Illinois are such that they make, there's a large enough African American population to support an African American candidate, particularly in the in a Democratic primary, but also we're obviously not a southern state, so I think the opposition among whites for African American candidates is probably not as strong as in some states where there are more African Americans.
What was noteworthy also is that Obama went way beyond Carol Moseley Braun's base of mm-hmm. that liberal coalition and African American coalition that Keith mentioned, and Obama, to his credit, significantly was able to make much more inroads to a broad base of appeal all across the state, in rural parts of Illinois, as well as in the cities and suburbs.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you know, initially he really was trying to replicate Moseley Braun's coalition, but he really went way beyond that in the end. And, you know, in his Democratic Senate primary, he won 52% of the vote, I think, in a seven-candidate race. So that's really an amazing performance.
Yeah. And how was he able to take that experience and put it on the national stage?
Well, certainly one way was building an incredible grassroots organization. Obama's campaign in both the Senate and the presidency was strategic and incredibly well run. David Axelrod, as one of his advisors in both campaigns, is probably one of the most brilliant campaign strategists around. And so the grassroots organization, as well as cutting-edge use of technology and communication, the Internet, the World Wide Web, social networking, and I think the third aspect was really fundraising prowess, the ability to raise large sums of money.
Yeah. He's also very popular with people.
Yeah, I mean, clearly he's almost a once-in-a-generation political talent. I mean, I remember the first time I saw him, and I had never even really heard of him. He came to speak for a local state Senate candidate, and I live in Macomb, Illinois, and he had gotten lost coming here, and I was getting really impatient. I almost left. And then when he actually showed up and he started talking, I was like, man, this guy is incredible. And, you know, one of my students was there, and I kind of asked him, well, was that just me, or, you know, were you blown away by that? And he said, yeah, that guy's really something. So I think just his personal qualities, you know, I've seen a lot of politicians, but he just is really beyond the typical politician, almost, you know, again, a once-in-a-generation kind of talent.
Yeah, and part of his message and part of the feeling you get from him is this idea of hope. And that's been such a part of the story and appeal of him. You want to talk about that? How does that figure into who he is and why people take to him?
I think, as Keith said, there really is a presence and a charisma that Barack Obama carries. And I think it's authentically Mr. Obama. It's not a facade. He genuinely has a vision and a passion for serving his country and the state at the time. And that's almost contagious. You really, you know, get caught up in the idea that he is helping us lead a movement for change. And you heard that rhetoric in the presidential race, that it's not about him. It was a grassroots movement that we're all part of. And you feel, you felt part of that movement, and you felt that you were actually participating in the election and in the campaign and creating a new government. And his oratory skills and the message and his rhetoric were inspiring and lofty. And I think people, it really resonated with people. And I think people, too, also felt that they were heard by Mr. Obama. Even if his policy positions or if he didn't agree with you, you felt that you had an audience. You felt that you were heard and that he understood your concerns.
Yeah, I think, let me pick up on one aspect of that, too. I think he really has this ability to connect with people, whoever they are, to make him feel like, oh, I'm like you somehow. I mean, for me, as a political scientist, I was struck the first time I saw him that he seemed to have mastered a lot of works in political science and things like that. And, like, connected with me that way, but I think for everybody, there's something that he is able to appeal to in them, and they say, oh, yeah, he understands me, or he's like me somehow, which is an amazing talent. I'm not sure exactly how he does it, but somehow he seems to be able to do that for most people, at least.
One of the things that he has been able to do as a politician is reach out in an effort to cool the heat of the hot button stuff and try to pull people in to be inclusive. As an example of this might be his choice of both the Reverend Rick Warren and Bishop Gene Robinson to take part in the upcoming inaugural events. Has this been typical of him since his entrance into politics, and is it a strength, or might it also be problematic?
Well, I think it has been, you know, at least going back to his Senate campaign, he's really focused on the kind of bread and butter issues more as opposed to the culture war issues. I mean, a lot of people, and this is certainly not original to us, but a lot of people have seen him as kind of the first post-1960s candidate who's not refighting the Vietnam War or, you know, some of the other issues that came from that era. So I think in that sense, you know, he is a little bit different than what we've seen. In terms of the, you know, the Rick Warren, Eugene Robinson thing, I'm not sure how all that plays out. I mean, in some ways, I think he may have stirred things up a little bit more than he thought he might, particularly with Rick Warren, but I guess the jury's still out on that a little bit.
In a way, I think it is very typical of Obama, which is to create dialogue. I know that people in the gay and lesbian communities were not very happy with his selection of Rick Warren, and there was a lot of backlash, and there was some question whether Reverend Robinson was invited to counter that. And I'm not, and they didn't, of course, I think the transition team denies that, but I think that there is a clear precedent for Obama sitting down with people that he agrees with and people that he doesn't agree with and talking to them and, again, hearing their concerns and trying to find a middle-of-the-road solution or middle-of-the-road position to some of the most controversial issues of the day.
And how does that translate into making policy?
I think, again, and we've seen the example of Obama as a U.S. senator and in Springfield of reaching across the aisle and trying to find a pragmatic middle-of-the-road solution. And I think we'll see that in some of his positions as president as well.
I mean, I was kind of interested at his pretty strong, at least immediate stance on revoking Don't Ask, Don't Tell, because I think historically he has not really focused a lot on social issues, quote unquote, if you want to call them that. You know, he was criticized for kind of ducking the abortion issue a lot of times in the state legislature, voting present, and so forth, and really focus more on more bread and butter issues like health care a lot of times, or also ethics reform, which I think almost everyone basically agrees with. So I think it's definitely true, as Marty said, that he's really trying to find a middle ground on a lot of these issues. I'm interested to see how he plays on some of the social issues as he goes forward. I would be surprised, I guess, if he focuses on those too much, at least in the first couple of years.
Mm. Keith Bachelman and Martin Dupuy are our guests this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. They're two political scientists. They are the authors of Barack Obama, The New Face of American Politics. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now from a listener in Rockford, line 4. Hi.
Yes, I had some comments about Barack Obama. Everything you've said about him pretty much also applied to Adolf Hitler in the 1930s. He was a very good speaker, very charismatic. The people were in a poor economic state, as we had somewhat here, and were swayed to somebody who'd do a bunch of slick talking like a slick used car salesman. And that's how Obama has impressed me.
Well, I'll...
A lot of the things he has said are not true, and he blamed the economic condition on the last 8 years repeatedly when we know it's been, this situation has been building up for over 20 years.
I'm going to jump in here and ask our guest to comment. I don't think really there is any comparing those two figures.
Well, I do think there are differences in the sense that I don't really see Obama scapegoating any particular part of the population. So I guess I would see him as quite a bit different in that respect, or trying to seize power in undemocratic ways, you know, a lot of things that Hitler did.
Yeah.
Also, it occurs to me that Obama's opponent, Republican opponent in the Senate race, was also a very eloquent spokesman. Alan Keyes was articulate and intelligent and very conservative, and the Illinois voters rejected his candidacy handily in the Senate race. And so I think that style alone isn't enough, and Illinois voters have shown that in the Senate race that put Obama in Washington, D.C.
Let's take another call. A listener in Terre Haute, line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I was very interested in your comments about the selection of Rick Warren to participate in the inauguration, and I, like you all, listening to the talking heads, the pundits, trying to figure out what is Obama about in that choice, what's he trying to say. And then I happened to stumble across on the cable C-SPAN, Rick Warren addressing a Muslim Leadership Institute. I don't know if you all had a chance to see that or not, but it became real apparent to me as to why Obama is reaching out to Warren. And it has nothing to do, it seems to me at least, maybe naive, about trying to engage the evangelical right, because Obama, I think, is smart enough to know that he will never accept the ballot of Saddleback congregation. But Warren, in that speech to these Muslim leaders, was talking about how one of his sayings was, he said, I don't have to see eye to eye to walk hand in hand with somebody. And he was reaching out to the Muslim community, and then aside, threw in a reference to Melissa Etheridge, who was in the audience as one of his favorites, hoping she would autograph his album. And Warren, personally, and his wife and his church, is so involved with what's, you know, faith-based initiatives. And it seems to me that, and I'd like to hear you more, comment more about Obama's attitude, but Obama as a community organizer working through churches, seeing the ability of churches to make an impact on communities, it just seemed to me to be a hand-in-glove fit to reach out to that kind of evangelical, not for political reasons, but simply to move the social agenda, for instance, abortion, agreeing to disagree, but trying to provide a situation where women who make a choice to carry a child to term have the support either from the government or from faith-based community groups, things we can't agree about. And I just really like to hear your comments. And the other thing is if me sitting out here catching this channel on C-SPAN gave me that insight, I just wonder, A, is my insight screwed up, or B, how come the talking heads that get paid money to sit on these shows on real television, I've never heard that from them, and I'll listen to them take your answer off the air.
Okay.
I think the comment about the faith-based initiatives, I think, is right on. I think that Obama is legitimately believes, partly because of his experience as a community organizer in Chicago, that faith-based institutions are a good way to solve a lot of social problems. So I think that is right on. As far as the speech that Rick Warren gave, the caller referred to, I haven't seen that, so I can't really comment on that. But I would say one more aspect of this is that Rick Warren did invite Obama to speak at the Saddleback Church. I think it was pretty early in his presidential campaign, or maybe even before. I don't remember exactly the dates on those. But there's been some speculation that, you know, Obama feels like he owes Rick Warren a little bit for putting him in the spotlight at that time, at a time when he really needed it. I think that, you know, the caller's right that Obama's probably never going to get a majority of evangelicals. But I think he may be able to pick up some and also kind of tamp down any opposition that he might have. So I guess those are some of my thoughts.
And Mr. Obama did meet with Reverend Warren and Bishop Robinson during the campaign, as Keith said. So these are new people for Obama to be interacting with. He's had some experience with them in the past. I think the caller's point is well taken as well, in that there are a lot of issues where we can find agreement and we can work together. And by reaching out to a constituency that you wouldn't think would support Mr. Obama is a real sign, I think, of his desire to be a president for all people and to work with all folks to find good common ground where we can work for the education of our children and the needs of the poor, things where we all have a shared interest regardless of some of our other religious beliefs.
Let's take another call. Listener in Champaign, line two. Hi.
Hello. Les, always a good show on Will. I find it insulting to hear someone call in and compare our president-elect to Hitler. Quite frankly, you need someone of his stature and charisma to try to move to the middle. To me, the only way that we're going to solve the many problems that we have in this country, not only social, but especially the economic problems today, is that you're going to have to bring everybody to the process. And I believe that President Obama will do that. And once again, I'm just insulted that someone would compare this man, our president-elect, to, and he's going to be our president, to Hitler. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call this afternoon. Any comment?
Again, I don't really agree with that analogy either. So I don't know that I need to comment further than that.
Okay.
I was going to mention something the previous caller had asked about, which is the media's coverage of some of these issues.
Mm-hmm.
And he was inquiring why there isn't more publicity around some of these overtures and meetings that do try to find common ground. And I think there's more of that. Certainly radio stations such as this and National Public Radio and PBS do try to give more attention to the details of what's going on in the news of the day. Unfortunately, other media, which is more sensationalized, looks for controversy and scandal rather than some of the positive work that's being done all across the country.
I just to kind of follow up on that too. I mean, I see maybe a little bit of a trend toward the media possibly following Obama's example a little bit too, and maybe trying to present more substance in some cases. I mean, I think there hasn't been as much focus on some of, you know, or maybe manufactured scandals as you sometimes see.
Well, let's look back at Barack Obama's experience as a community organizer in Chicago, his time in the Illinois legislature and the U.S. Senate, and his campaign for president, and what they tell us about or what they might indicate about Barack Obama as president.
Well, I think that clearly I think the experience as a community organizer is kind of a formative one for him in the sense that he's really built his campaign on this grassroots organizing model, that he had more organizers built in, you know, throughout the country than anybody else by far. In the Democratic primaries, he emphasized the caucus states, which also tend to reward a well-organized campaign, and that's really what put him over in the Democratic primaries. And so, you know, I think that was obviously a very important era for him. I think politically, maybe some of the ideas of compromise and listening to other people. I think maybe he developed those skills to some degree as a community organizer. You know, it's a very difficult job in the sense that you're kind of fighting for the underdog, and it's impossible really to get anything done if you're not willing to compromise. So I think those skills that he's praised for of listening to other people or different points of view and cooperating with the other side, I think a lot of those may have come out of those the experience as a community organizer, as well as in the state legislature. You know, I think he had a reputation there as well as being someone who could work with Republicans, and I think that was obviously an important venue for him. I think it's pretty clear, though, that he was never going to be satisfied with serving in the state legislature for his career, and that he was ready to move up pretty quickly to higher office.
Indeed, it's rumored that if Barack did not win the U.S. Senate seat, that he would have left public office and gone into a career that was more family-friendly, perhaps teaching at the University of Chicago full-time.
Hmm.
Just the demands, I think, of public office are great. And as Keith mentioned, there appeared to be a fair amount of dissatisfaction with being limited to a state platform. And his interests really were, and these interests, I think, do come out of his community organizing around issues of jobs and employment and health care and education. And he thought he could, you know, he could be more effective, and it was more rewarding to look at how to be a catalyst on the national stage. But I think perhaps Michelle Obama got more than she bargained for, because if Obama hadn't won the U.S. Senate race, he wouldn't be moving to the White House in a few days. And if he hadn't won, they'd be living probably a pretty quiet, unpublicized life in Chicago.
How does this happen in an individual? You have great ambition, and then you also have, he could be living a quiet life as a family guy in Chicago.
Well, I think it's also a testament not only to Barack himself, but to Michelle. And that it really was, or from what we've been able to glean, really was a family decision about whether to undertake this kind of campaign, whether it be the Senate race, and then, of course, even the presidential race, which is exponentially more demanding. And there is some suggestion that Mr. Obama didn't really fully understand the implications of a national campaign. He's alleged to have said to his aides right in the beginning of the presidential race, "Will I be able to go back and see my wife and kids on the weekend?" And, of course, that wasn't to be the case. But it really is a family effort, and Michelle Obama herself is an incredible public servant as well.
Yeah. Later this month, we're going to talk about Michelle Obama with her biographer. So that's coming up later this month. She's an interesting figure as well. Let's take another call. West Side of Champaign, Line 1. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. And I have several questions about some of the selections that Obama has made for his cabinet.
Mm-hmm.
For one thing, the guy that doesn't believe in paying income tax is going to head the Treasury Department. Come on, give me a break, boy. What kind of fool nonsense is that? And secondly, are you familiar with Condoleezza Rice and the great work she's done overseas? Why would Obama replace her with Hillary Clinton, if I understand correctly?
Okay, there's a couple of good questions. Let's talk about the transition to date and some of the problems that have come up as the nominees have been made to head various cabinet posts.
Overall, I think the transition has gone incredibly smooth. Mr. Obama appointed or nominated or at least selected his cabinet officials way before most other presidents of recent time have. So he really went quickly and started naming some very good people. And unlike President Clinton or even President Bush, I think his nominees have been relatively clean from any other kind of controversy. And his selection for the Treasury Secretary did pay income tax. He just had made some errors, and that's not a good sign. But I think we need to be careful in holding our public officials up to a standard of perfection, because you know it's a standard that very few people could meet, and that some of these errors really aren't all that significant.
Okay, but we do have Bill Richardson who bowed out of his cabinet nomination.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's. I mean, you can look at that in different ways. I think so far, at least as I understand it, there's been no evidence that Bill Richardson is directly involved, but I think that there were concerns that this scandal might reach to him eventually. So, I mean, I guess one way to look at it is that the Obama team kind of forced him out to preempt any scandals. On the Geithner thing, the Treasury Secretary-designate, you know, it is embarrassing, clearly. I think it's probably not an ideal situation, but I think that he seems to have enough support, including from some Republicans, that he will probably still be confirmed, I assume. And Condoleezza Rice, I don't know that she was interested in staying as Secretary of State, in all honesty. I think that, and I don't know one way or the other, but I haven't really heard much speculation that she would really want to stay in further. Generally, presidents make most of their appointments from the same party, and there's obviously exceptions like Robert Gates staying on at defense, but I think that that's normally the exception, not the rule.
Yeah, and also in transportation, we've got an Illinois Republican.
Yeah, that's right, Ray LaHood.
So. Okay. Speaking of Secretary of State, in your book, Barack Obama, The New Face of American Politics, you noted the likelihood that he would have a great deal of appeal internationally. How far might that capital take his administration, including his Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, in foreign affairs?
I think from what I'm aware of, he's very popular overseas, particularly in Europe and some places where President Bush was not very popular. So I think it certainly helps them. But I think really foreign policy is about differing interests, and so I think it only takes them so far. I think when the interests are at odds with other nations, there's going to be tension regardless of who's president. So I think it sets a tone that's maybe more positive than it has been, but I guess I think we'll see when we get to situations where actual interests are at stake, and then it may be a little bit different story.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guests this afternoon, Martin Dupuy and Keith Bockelman. They are the authors of Barack Obama, The New Face of American Politics. They are political scientists. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222. WILL. Well, what are the qualities of a successful president, and does Barack Obama have them?
Well, a lot of a lot of studies of the presidency focus on the so-called power persuasion, and that's essentially the ability to convince the public, convince Congress, those kind of the ability to bargain, the ability to be effective on TV, to give good speeches. I think from that respect, he's got a lot going for him, obviously. I mean, he's a very effective communicator. And by all accounts, he's also effective behind the scenes. So I think all signs point to a promising presidency from that respect.
I think so, too. Some other qualities that we might use to evaluate leadership and presidential leadership would be organization and vision and intellect. And Obama certainly demonstrated great organizational capacity with his presidential campaign. I think that his vision is inspiring, and he does seem to want to work for solutions that can unite much of the country. And intellect, certainly he's one of the more thoughtful people that have run for the office, and I think that interest in exploring ideas and working through ideas, having disagreement discussed and considered in his deliberations on policy positions will also bode well for him.
I mean, I think the one issue that's maybe a concern that we raise in the book a little bit, and others have raised as well, it's certainly not only us, but, you know, he doesn't have a lot of executive experience. He's coming into a situation where he needs to manage the entire federal government. He's really never taken on anything like that before. I think by all accounts, his campaign was very well managed, but you're dealing with a different kind of situation where you come in to manage a civil service where you don't really get to pick the people who are working for you, and obviously it's much more vast. So I think, yeah, as Martin said, I think on most qualities like intelligence and so forth, ability to work with other people, he has a very promising outlook. But I think that would be one area of concern.
Mm. What do you look for him to say when he addresses the nation as the new president on Tuesday?
That's a great question. I mean, I wish I could. I knew. I was looking through the other day President Roosevelt's first inaugural from 1933, and it kind of struck me that Obama could almost give that speech verbatim. He obviously won't, but so I guess what I'm trying to say is I suspect that he will try to reassure people about the economy and that a lot of those issues will be front and center. But I think he'll also come back to some of the themes that he stressed throughout his speeches in his career, you know, try to unify the country, the idea of not being a red and blue America, but a united America, and changing the tone of politics. So I think he'll come back to those themes as well.
Mm.
Also, sort of in the Kennedy vein, I think he'll be calling on America to make sacrifices and to be of service. You know, on Monday, Martin Luther King's holiday, both the Obama and Biden families are doing service work in their communities. And so there is this emphasis, too, I think, that we will hear about community service, working for the common good, and uniting to handle the economic crisis that face us and to unite to handle the international challenges that face us.
Yeah. I was struck yesterday. I learned that he has chosen the Bible that Abraham Lincoln used when he was sworn in for his Bible to be sworn in with. And I thought that maybe that's telling, too. I'm sure he's been a student of the great speeches of Lincoln.
Well, yeah, and I think that's another thing that we might see as well. He's obviously drawn parallels with his own career in Lincoln many times. One thing, you know, we think of Lincoln as a Civil War president, obviously, but I think one thing we might see Obama emphasize is Lincoln's economic policies and economic platforms. Lincoln was a great promoter of science, of infrastructure, you know, building the Intercontinental Railroad and things like that. So given the economic challenges we're facing right now, I think we might see some emphasis on drawing parallels with those aspects of Lincoln's career.
I want to talk a little bit about, if you don't mind, about our political situation in Illinois.
Sure.
I was struck by the backgrounder that you give at the outset of Chapter 2, Will It Play in Peoria? Barack Obama's U.S. Senate victory occurred in a state with a tradition of pragmatic, individualistic, even corrupt politics.
How could we say something like that?
Well, I'm wondering, will Illinois' political scandals affect him at all? Have they touched him?
I don't really think they have significantly. I mean, I think that there's an effort to try to link him to Illinois' political scandals. I guess in my own view that hasn't worked very much. Maybe Marty has a better picture of this actually being outside of Illinois. Maybe I'll let you say something about that.
As Keith was mentioning, I think there's been an attempt to connect President Obama to his Senate replacements and the scandal around that. But I don't think that there's really much there to to make that connection. But I think it's unfortunate, though, in a way, when Illinois is in the limelight and the favorite son is soon going to be president of the United States, that there is this cloud that kind of undermines the prestige and the pride that the state would have from sending a senator to the White House. So it's sort of unfortunate just from more of a feel-good type of perspective.
Mm-hmm. And Keith, back here in Illinois, do you think we'll see clean government initiatives in the Illinois legislature as a result of the scandals we've seen, especially in light of the arrest and impeachment of the governor?
I do. I mean, there have been repeated efforts, including when Barack Obama was in the state legislature, that was a central focus of his. It's very difficult sometimes to get these things through the legislature. They're often killed procedurally because they would usually pass or they were actually voted on. I do think that we got two new leaders in the state Senate, both a new state Senate president and a new Senate minority leader, and that may set an atmosphere where it's a little bit easier to get some of these things through. I still think sometimes it's a long shot to make substantial reforms, but I guess I will stay also somewhat hopeful.
Do you think campaign finance reform is a key element to that in Illinois?
I do. I mean, that's one thing that's being talked about again, and Lieutenant Governor Quinn has said that if he becomes governor, that's something he'll emphasize. There's been some discussion also putting limits like at the federal level. Right now there are basically no dollar limits on how much you can contribute. The legislature did pass a legislation last session putting some limits on state contractors, but in terms of dollar amounts, there are really no limits on what you can do in Illinois. So I think there's at least going to be legislation introduced to do that, whether it'll pass or not.
One of the figures that is in Barack Obama, the new face of American politics who gets mentioned is Peter Fitzgerald and his experience as a U.S. senator from Illinois, a Republican. And we saw in his case the difficulty of bucking the powers that be.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think it's ironic. I mean, his legacy is really appointing Patrick Fitzgerald as U.S. attorney, and probably more than anything, he's done the most to try to clean up Illinois politics. I mean, pretty aggressive, moving against corruption. So in that respect, he at least had some success, posthumously maybe.
Mm. And do you think Patrick Fitzgerald will remain in his post as U.S. attorney for the Northern District?
Obama has promised to reappoint him, I believe. Now, whether he accepts that or not, I don't know, but I would assume that he would.
Okay, let's take another call before we're out of time here. Listener in Champaign on line one. Hello?
Yes. One of the things I admire about Obama is his calm under very pressurizing situations. He's demonstrated that a few times. Just a comment there, but I wanted to move to the question of Illinois politics. Do you think our Senate is going to go ahead and find our governor guilty?
I think it's hard to comment without the evidence. I happen to be a lawyer as well, and I'd be concerned about passing judgment before evidence is presented. And that's somewhat technical, but I think that we can't let Governor Blagojevich be tried in the press. That the evidence needs to be presented to the Senate and carefully presented, and the governor needs a chance to rebut that before we should cast judgment.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it's hard to make predictions, really. I think of the two bodies, the Senate has been more supportive of the governor than the House. Now, again, there's a leadership change that's going on right now, so that may change somewhat. But I think it's hard to make predictions. I think Marty is right that it's best to wait and see what all the evidence is.
Mm. And even saying that, though, it certainly doesn't look good for the governor, does it?
No.
No, I no.
Let's take another call. One last call this afternoon. Chicago, line four. Hi.
Thank you. Change is a part of the universe, and yet we find former Senator Stevenson from Illinois saying one reason he no longer choose to continue running is that it's so difficult to produce change. Now, the likelihood of surgical procedures or transplants and whatever words one used to enliven and transform our monetary system, our political system, and that can be sort of doubtless, but how and how long it's going to take is unforeseen. But former Press Secretary President Johnson said that given the size of situations and people that want to personally see the president and bring issues to him, it's so staggering that he feels that the position of the president is more than one person can handle. And we've seen how many of them can barely assimilate, let alone digest and respond to all the issues. So the question of having one person as a king, a monarch, a president ought to be rethought, as well as our whole monetary system and whatever bridge is going to be needed to negotiate this transformation. We'll look forward to.
I mean, there's certainly an argument that jobs gotten too big for one person, and I think maybe the other problem the caller's alluding to is that, you know, our solutions to social problems, economic problems, and the like, they're not precise. I mean, certainly political sciences or policy science is a lot less precise even than medical science, and even there are unintended consequences. So it's a lot of times hard to predict how these things are actually going to work in practice, particularly when you're in such a unprecedented situation like we are now with the economy.
Do you see a growing role for the vice president? Dick Cheney certainly has been a very active vice president. I don't know about Joe Biden, Al Gore. Is the role of the vice president changing here?
I don't see what Keith says. I don't necessarily see any major shift in the role of the vice president with Biden. I think organizationally it'd be very difficult to have sort of a co-presidency.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that Biden is going to play more of an advisory role, particularly in foreign policy, probably. But I think Obama is definitely going to be the one in charge and the executive, so to speak. And that I think he'll probably play a less active role than either Cheney or Al Gore, would be my guess, at least in terms of actually administering things. Now, he may be an important advisor, but I think in terms of actual direct administration, I think it'll be less than what we've seen in the last two presidents, or vice presidents, I should say.
There, we've got to wrap it up. Keith Bockelman is a political scientist at Western Illinois University, and Martin Dupuis is at the University of Central Florida. He is a political scientist. He also holds a JD from American University. They are the authors together of Barack Obama, The New Face of American Politics. The book is published by Prager. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Celeste.
Thank you.
It is 1:53. Settlement prices should be in from Chicago and Kansas City. Here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Celeste, and good Thursday afternoon, everyone. Wheat and corn futures slipped today on USDA confirmation of poor export sales from last week. Also bearish was talk of Argentina's government approving additional wheat exports of 1.2 million tons, as well as in corn, talk of China may exporting more corn this coming year. Meanwhile, the beans going the other direction. They gained on Argentine crop worries, as well as continued strong Chinese demand for soybeans. The Chinese taking 30 million metric tons of the 50 million metric ton total off of last week's export sales report. Let's go ahead and look at the particulars. In Kansas City, as we look at the screen, we see March wheat trading on the high of 604, the low of 590 and three quarters, settling 594 and a half, down 5 1/2. May, a high of 616 and a half, a low of 602 and three quarters, settling 605 and a half, down 5 3/4. March wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, the high 577, the low 562 and three quarters, settling 588 and three quarters, down 5 1/2. July, a high of $6, a low of 586 and a half, settling 592 and three quarters, down 5 1/4. December, a high of 645, a low of 630, settling 636 and three quarters, down 3 1/2. July of 2010, a high of 663, a low of 653, settling 657 and three quarters, down 5 1/2. March corn, a high of 369 and a quarter, a low of 359 and three quarters, settling 365 and a quarter, down one and a quarter. May, a high of 380 and a quarter, a low of 371, settling 376 and a quarter, down one and a quarter. July, a high of 390 and a quarter, a low of 381 and a quarter, settling 386 and a half, down one and a quarter. December, a high of 414 and a half, a low of 405, settling 411, down a half. July of 2010, a high of 436 and a half, a low of 443, settling 436 and a half, down one. December of 2010, a high of 435, a low of 429, settling 433 and a half, down one and a half. March oats, a high of 217 and three quarters, a low of 210 and a half, settling 217 up one. May, a high of 226 and a quarter, a low of 221 and a half, settling 226 and a half up one. March beans, a high of 1025, a low of 957 and three quarters, settling 994 and a half, up 23. May, a high of 1032 and a half, a low of 966 and a quarter, settling 1003 and a quarter, up 23. July, a high of 1041, a low of 976, settling 1013 and a quarter, up 23 and a quarter. November, a high of 989 and a quarter, a low of 942 and three quarters, settling 960 and a half, up five and a quarter. March of 2010, a high of 991 and a quarter, a low of 972 and a half, settling 972 and a half, up four. March soybean meal, a high of 316.60, a low of 292.50, settling 305, up $8. May, a high of 317.60, a low of 294.80, settling 306.50, up 790. March soybean oil, a high of $35, a low of 33.64, settling 34.40, up 35. May, a high of 35.37, a low of 34.01, settling 34.77, up 34. Coming up on the closing market report at 6 past the hour, Dan Zwicker of ADM Ag Group out of Decatur, Illinois, will give us his technical look at the marketplace. And later that half hour, we'll also hear from Barack Obama's nominee for USDA Secretary. He is Tom Vilsack, the former two-term governor from Iowa. We'll have the prices from CME Livestock in just a moment. This is Dave Dickey.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
February live cattle, the high today 84.57 and a half, the low 82.95, the settlement 84.35, up $1. April, 88 even, the high 86.20, the low 87.30, the settlement at up 47 and a half. June, 86.50, the high 84.80, the low 85.70, the settlement that unchanged. August, 86.70, the high 85.45, the low 86.37 and a half, the settlement that up 12 and a half. January feeder cattle, 95.60, the high 94.30, the low, the settlement 95 even, that down 70. March, 94.90, the high 92.95, the low, the settlement 94.30, that down 32 and a half. April, 96.40, the high 94.55, the low 95.55, the settlement that down 67 and a half. May 97.50, the high 95.90, the low 97.30, the settlement that down 12 and a half. February lean hogs 59.95, the high 59.12 and a half, the low, the settlement 59.82 and a half, the settlement for February lean hogs that down 10. April 66.10, the high 65.30, the low, the settlement 65.85, down 85. May 77.40, the high 76.40, the low 77.20, the settlement that down $1. June 78.45, the high 77.55, the low, the settlement 77.90, that down 112 and a half. And February pork bellies 84.95, the high 83.10, the low, the settlement 83.80, that down 1. 25. The Dow is up 23. The